This is John Paxson, News Director at Northwest Public Radio. We hope you will join us now for a special broadcast on the Information Age in the state of Washington. The state has some of the world's leading technology companies, yet some areas have very little locally relevant public affairs news. It is home to such giants as Microsoft and Amazon, yet it has only 20 daily newspapers, and television is clustered in just 4 cities. In most of those cities, access to the digital universe is nearly universal, but in some parts of rural Washington, it is virtually non-existent. This information and digital divide was subject of a day-long symposium recently at the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University. As part of a Carnegie Knight FCC initiative exploring information needs in the United States, the college and its founding dean, Dr. Lawrence Pintack, brought together more than 24 technology and information experts. They offered a critical examination of the information landscape across the state, with a particular emphasis on the information needs of rural communities. In the following report, you'll hear from the actual people working, thinking, and planning in the heart of Washington's news and digital landscape. Among them are Frieda Ray of the Washington Broadband Office, Representative John McCoy, who chairs the legislature's Technology, Energy, and Communications Committee, and Christy Kirkpatrick, a Whitman County librarian. You'll also hear from journalists Mike Shepard of the Seattle Times, Butch Alfred of the Lewiston Tribune, and Gary Graham of the Spokesman Review. Steve Wood, one of the original employees of Microsoft and now the head of the Washington Technology Industry Association, concludes the hour with a summary of where he thinks we are headed in the new digital universe. So now, a look at Washington's information landscape.
Thanks so much to everyone for coming today. We really appreciate it. I'm Lawrence Pintack. I'm the dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication. I must say, I am not a native of this region. I'm one of those Northeast guys who's an interloper. And in coming in, and particularly I think the first time I drove from here to Seattle, which as many of you know can be a pretty mind-numbing experience in parts, I really have been amazed and a bit appalled at the, what I call, information black holes in the state. And that's obviously an overgeneralization. But the number of towns that do not have a newspaper or a radio station that actually provides local news, because we all know there are radio stations that are centrally programmed, and the building may burn down, but they're never going to be able to report that the building burned down. So we've been looking at this issue for a while in various ways. And about 6 months ago, I got a call from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which many of you is actually a foundation that I've done. I do a variety of work with on different projects. And there's something called the Carnegie Knight Initiative for the Future of Journalism. It's been around for a few years, maybe 5 years or so. And it's 12 of the elite, in quotes, journalism schools who have been funded by Carnegie and the Knight Foundation to try and figure out where journalism is going. And then it's taken a few other side turns into other related projects. And the initiative is actually kind of phasing out. But this last project they're doing, and now we're doing, is a look at the FCC information needs report that came out last summer, and many of you are familiar with it. It came out, and there was a thump, and then it disappeared. And so what they decided, and Knight helped fund this report, by the way, so they had a stake in this. So they said, let's take these 12 schools and have them look at different aspects of the report, and get conversations going on a local and regional level around aspects of this report. And much to our good luck, Northwestern wasn't able to participate, so we were asked to step in as the 12th school. These others are doing various parts of the report. We're specifically looking at the rural issue, rural information access, which obviously is a logical thing to be looking at in this state. With that, let me introduce Frieda Ray. Some of you know there is a state broadband office. And when we first started looking at this a couple of years ago, I looked at some fascinating data that the state broadband office in the guise of a different person who's sitting at this table, had produced. And Frida has brought us some maps. Well, I won't steal your thunder, but we have some interesting data to look at about broadband penetration. Frida Ray.
Thank you. It's going to be an important discussion for our state and, of course, the future of media. And we're happy to contribute what we can to that wealth of information. Also, the heart of our work is not just about the technology, but about what broadband enables in the way of benefits for health, education, public safety, and so forth. So this speaks right to the heart of our mission. We'll talk a little bit about what we do and how we arrived, how we got a state broadband office. But basically, nationally, $4.7 billion was awarded through ARRA funding for projects that included infrastructure build-out, some of the folks that are working on that are represented here, public computer centers, and sustainable adoption programs. All 50 states also received a state broadband data and development grant to establish a state office charged with integrating broadband into local and state economies. There are people here who know it way better than I do. But basically, in case general audience sees this, we should know that broadband is typically measured in speed. Speed is the amount of time it takes data to move from one place to another. And it's usually expressed in megabits per second, although we can get into the kilobits and gigabits later. The map data indicates that 96.1% of Washington households have access to 3 megabits or more. And that is access to now or could have access in 7 days, I believe, is the reporting standard. And nearly 79% of the population have access to 25 megabits, which is the 12th highest percentage of the population with access at that level in the nation. There's more good news. More than 1.3 million broadband connections are in use in Washington State already, seventh highest in the nation. And we have the third highest adoption rate in the nation with 77% adoption rate. And our urban and rural split, which is an issue, kind of speaks to what your symposium is about 9%. If you go to states like, I think Missouri has it's almost a 50% split.
What do you mean by a split?
When you compare the adoption rate in an urban area, it'd be about 75 or so, or 77, and then it'd be 9% less in rural areas in our state. So compared to other states, it's not, the urban-rural divide isn't quite as bad as you might think. Just 3.88% of the state's households have no access to broadband, and another 2.3% have access at less than 3 megabits. Many of these areas are either sparsely populated, 20 people per square mile or less, or have high rates of poverty, or both. For instance, Yakima, Grays Harbor, Whatcom Ferry, and Clallam County all have areas with no broadband provider, yet for every 100 people in that county, 34 to 50 are clients of DSH for either economic, vocational, or medical services. So what's the new digital divide? It's about speed. And I want to give a story based on, we're from the Department of Commerce, so it's a business story. We have the Buggy Barn in Reardon, which has a lovely site, and as a quilter, I must go. But they actually ship nationally and internationally based on the traffic they get on their website. However, they do demonstration videos, which is kind of important in quilting. They have to go into town and upload the video to YouTube because they don't have a speed connection fast enough there. And, of course, when they go back to their shop, they can't watch it. Conversely, A Touch of Dutch in Coopville, very seasonal business selling, as you might imagine, Dutch items, including shipping them overseas. In fact, they have shipped stuff to Holland, which I find amusing. However, for a long time, she was saying, I've got great service here, but I can't work at home. As a small business owner, this is a problem. In the last year, because of broadband upgrades, she has sufficient speed at home to handle the website of her business at home. It accounts for about 30% of her income and makes her seasonal business year-round. And so I guess I would raise this as sort of that question you kick around going forward, is what does this mean when we talk about citizen journalist and content creation, especially if you're having some kind of two-way conversation? Symmetrical helps quite a bit. So it may be the next thing to work on beyond.
Because we have non-specialists, these guys know what you're talking about. Explain symmetrical and non-symmetrical.
Yeah, you have upload and download speeds. And typically your download speed is actually faster. That kind of developed out of that idea that we were consumers of things on the internet and videos and so forth. And upload is typically a lower bandwidth. Symmetrical would be a one-for-one. There are parts of Grant County, for instance, where they told us last year that they're delivering 100 megabits symmetrical to households, or can deliver that to households. So those folks can do high-def video conferencing and have somebody else playing a game, and they're good to go. What I'm concerned about, or what I think we need to be thinking about as a state, is what does that look like over the long term as we get online, all of our kids get online, you know, we start reporting from Reardon. What does it look like? What are our needs going to be?
Thank you. John McCoy, you look at this issue from a both a 30,000-foot level and a grassroots level. Is there a divide? Is there a digital elite, and are others being left behind?
Yes, there are. It comes quite apparent every day. You know, it continues to grow. Frustration for me is that, you know, in getting broadband out to rural areas, you know, I'm a strong believer that economic development follows those trucks that are laying the fiber down the highway. They're following it, and they're getting into businesses out there. Because that's what happened at Tulalip, where I live. It's an Indian reservation, and quite a number of you know how well the economic development is done there. But I would not have been able to get that done if I had not first put in the infrastructure of broadband. Would have never happened. So, in looking at the problem statewide, there, you know, besides the incumbent big utilities on how they keep looking at the bottom line on determining whether they're going to go into an area or not, but we also have issues with local governments and some of the ordinances that they have in place, and that they're their own worst enemy on some of the deployments around the state. So we have to also educate the local governments that some of these rules they put in place hinder economic development, and they need to modify those rules, not only for broadband, but for also alternative energy. Broadband and alternative energy resources almost go hand in hand. So, watching how things are done around the state, yes, I see. You can be a community of medium means, but you could be very rich in technology, or you could even be almost a poor community but rich in technology. So it all balances out, and it's all in the eyes of the beholder on whether how you feel about yourself. And as I've talked with the various utilities and with Angela and some of the other nonprofits, you know, I keep telling them that you need to go out and educate. You may put Verizon, may put an asset out there. Okay, they put it out there, and now they're sitting there waiting for people to come. Well, those folks out in that community, 9 out of 10 times do not know the question to ask. What does this do for me? So there's got to be an education module. When they put an asset out there, they have to educate the community so that they understand what they have in their midst then and how it can help them. So there is that educational, of which then again also leads to the local government to educate them so they modify their local ordinances to allow for broadband to be brought in. And it's not only local government. The Colville tribe has got an issue with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They CenturyLink needs to renew a lease, and the BIA is not allowing the lease to be renewed to a cable cabinet.
Kirkpatrick. This issue of education in the community. You have your foot, Colfax Librarian, you have your foot in all of these small communities along with Colfax. Is there a problem of education? Do people intrinsically know this, or do they need to be taught it?
Both, I would say. And my head is spinning listening to everybody speak, because in libraries we see so many sides of this issue. As the way information is coming out and it's changing, and you know, so much is online now, and that's how, as a library, we know that's the way that we're going to now be sharing information with our patrons and our customers and our communities. But for us, the problem we're seeing is when the technology's not keeping up with it, we're going to conferences learning this is the way that you're going to now give your people their learning experiences, their news, their this sort of thing. I get home and say to my tech guy, we've got to do this. And he says, people can't access this from home. How we set up our websites, so much of what we do is determined by the technology. I agree with a few of you that have said, if the technology is there, the digital literacy will follow. We're in our rural areas waiting for that. And I think, and I agree also with Representative McCoy that those people follow that technology. We're slowly seeing people move into our rural areas wanting to do business and telecommuting and some of those opportunities, but getting that technology to our towns and our rural areas has just been a huge struggle. Our library, and it's pushed us into a place I haven't really wanted to be, because we're seeing that we can really be a way to help our towns get that technology. We're participating in a big statewide multi-million dollar grant, and we're doing those things to bring the technology as best we know how, but it's not necessarily an area of expertise for us. So we're sort of going in blindly and making decisions that I hope that this is a good grant we're involved in, and I hope we're doing this right, because I think our communities and the people that we serve, so many people depend on libraries for their information, and they're depending on us. And so I hope that we're making good choices and positive difference and trying to do that.
Do you find, you say so many people depend on our libraries, I mean, it's kind of a counterintuitive thing, I think, particularly for urbanites, that, you know, why have libraries anymore at all when we can get the Encyclopedia Britannica online in a $1.99 app?
Well, when you see a commercial on TV that you can now do this online, you have to do this online. You have to fill out your Social Security, your new retirement system. As everything moves online, you have so many people, for one, who don't even know how to go online, let alone have that access. And so we are busier than ever. Traditional book circulation dropping, online use going through the roof. But I think the biggest thing we're seeing is people in needing help. You know, apparently I can only get this through the internet. Can you show me how? We're going out to the schools, helping them with research classes. How do I sift through this overload of information? How do I get a good, reliable resource? A lot of things have fallen to libraries that nobody else has stepped in. And when you talked about taking the technology out there and then teaching people what that means to them, that's kind of what we're doing, but I would love the help. I mean, we're busier with different things than people realize, I think, now.
Doug Hindeman is associate professor here at Murrow. He and Michael Beam, there's Michael, blending into the background with a black jacket. Michael Beam and several others on the faculty have been working on a research project looking at media patterns and consumption and literacy around the region. And so I'll turn it over to them.
Well, thanks to Larry and the Carnegie Knight Foundation, we had some money to field a survey, which is ongoing as we speak in Washington State, that essentially replicates some of the findings from an earlier nationwide survey about the information needs of communities. So essentially asking citizens how it looks from their perspective in terms of their ability to get local news and implications of that lack of local news if they see that. I think one of the impetus for this conference and for the entire Carnegie Knight grant was the FCC report on the information needs of communities. Steve Waldman was the primary author of that. Unfortunately, he was unable to be here. But I wanted to just sort of share some of the findings of that report because they're particularly relevant to our concerns. He said in general, there's more media outlets available, but less local reporting. So new technology, having wired communities, having more cable outlets leads to more media outlets, but less local reporting. So that's the quandary that we're sort of facing, and it's an issue that we think affects rural communities more than the urban areas or even the regional cities. The extending that, if there's less local reporting, then how can citizens be active members of their community? How can they be vigilant about the issues happening within city government? How can they know, as Lyndon Lahey found out, that there's going to be megaloads going right down his highway blocking ambulance traffic? And that was not reported in local newspapers. He had to find out about it when he tells the story that the power went out in his house. He walked out to the road and started talking to the guys who were putting in 30-foot tall telephone poles to find out what the heck is going on. They said, well, there's some loads coming through here. So he may not take credit for it, but he sort of broke that story of the megaloads going up Highway 12, a very scenic highway, and did the investigative reporting, did the citizens' request for information, essentially broke that story. Not many people like Lyndon Lahey are out there, but I hope there are more. You know, some people say the solution to this problem is more citizen journalists, which I'm very skeptical of. Until I met Lyndon, I thought, wow, if they're like him, we can find out a lot about what's going on. But for the majority of people, I don't think we know what we're missing when our local newspapers go away. And our data are based on like now versus 5 years ago. This has been a 15, 20-year process, particularly 30 years in the case of broadcast declining coverage of local news. Citizens don't know what they're missing. My students don't know what they're missing when they don't read a local newspaper. Say, so how you move into a big city, how are you going to know what's going on? Well, I'll do Facebook. That doesn't tell you. How do you know who's Mr. Big? How do you know who the power structure is in a community? Because Facebook's not going to tell you that. Well, so here's some of the findings from that FCC report. Local newspapers, declining revenues, as we all know, partly because of the recession, but partly because of ads going to Craigslist and other online free sources. Reduced workforces, which goes hand in hand with those declining revenues, and more what we call reactive instead of enterprise reporting. You can do a great job of covering, you know, the tornadoes that went through Dallas, but it's harder to sort of talk about emergency preparation and those issues or the aftermath of a disaster, which takes a lot of reporting, helping people figure out how to make their way through the bureaucracy to solve the issues. This is some of Dean Pintak's research. 20 towns and cities have daily newspapers in this state now. 77 have weekly newspapers, but that includes Shoppers, which are very light on content. And that's small numbers for a big, diverse, booming state like Washington State. Local radio news, again, this is some of Waldman's findings. Rise of news talk format across rural areas is phenomenal. It's, I think, the second or third most popular format right now. But that's all about syndicated content. That's Rush Limbaugh. That's not local news. The true big city news stations, which are great, I mean, they're wonderful, Como's, those are irreplaceable. There's only 30 of those left nationwide. Those are great, but that's not what a news talk syndicated format station is. Local news outlets have declined since the 1980s thanks to FCC deregulation. In spite of what broadcasters told us at the time, if you just deregulate us, we'll have more local news. Well, guess what? That didn't happen. Public radio is growing. And the audiences are growing, although 2011 wasn't such a great year for various reasons. But few are really doing local news. LPFM, low power FM, are blossoming up, and there's more to be coming into small communities, little 100-watt stations, staffed by volunteers without journalistic credentials. They mean well, but they're just not necessarily filling the gap. Dean Pintek's work shows that only 23 radio stations with significant local news are still in place. Local TV news, well, you all know that that's the preferred source of news for a lot of folks. And again, people don't know what they're missing when they're getting all their news from local TV. And this shows essentially newspapers declining has now been eclipsed by online sources. And online sources are now sort of in parity with radio. And these are data from the Pew. So local TV news is preferred source. Hours of local TV news has increased as it's become profitable to add, you know, the 5 o'clock news before the network news, and then the 6 o'clock, and then the 6:30, and then the 4:30. They're adding these hours. A lot of that news is recycled. If you watch the 5 o'clock, you've seen the 6 o'clock, and many times you've seen the 11 o'clock, too. It's the same news over and over again. Even so, with the increased news hours, the news hole, we're seeing staff reductions, again, reflecting declining revenues, replacement of veteran reporters with novices who cost less, who don't do the enterprise reporting, minimal city government education reporting. Some studies have shown, say, 1 minute for maybe 10 minutes of crime in terms of local news. In Washington, TV stations are clustered in 4 metro areas, little coverage beyond the metro. And in our data, we see a lot of people also saying that their favorite local source is local television, but they're really not getting truly local television. They're getting Seattle news or Tri-Cities news. Let me turn this over to Michael.
So I'm just going to run through some of these actual information-seeking routines numbers from the national sample and then from our Washington citizen sample. So in the United States, in the way the Pew survey asked questions, they were asking all of their questions about getting local news. So we have people in rural areas, in newspapers, actually more likely to say that they are more often getting local news from newspapers about their looking into newspapers about their local communities from the national sample. In our Washington state sample, we decided to not only ask about local news, but also ask about state and national news gathering routines. So we asked, how often do you refer to newspapers for local news? How often do you refer to newspapers for state and national news? And we found here in Washington State that it's about the same for rural and non-rural people. So for television, again, this is the national sample, we find that a lot of people, more so than newspapers, say they're referring to local TV for local news. And there's no difference for non-rural and rural people in the national sample. But we do find in our Washington sample that for local news, that rural people are going to local TV news less often than non-rural people, but still more so than newspapers. We don't see any differences on state and national news seeking for Washington residents. And this is a pattern we see in a few of the questions we ask about for Washington citizens. We find that for local news, rural citizens are less likely to go for these information sources, whereas they're just as likely as the non-rural people to look for state and national news. And I think what this indicates is that it's not an issue of access to TV news, it's an issue of TV news isn't covering the rural locations as much as the non-rural locations. So for the national sample, looking at local news, we find that rural people are using radio less than non-rural people. For interpersonal discussion, again for the national sample, we find that rural people are actually talking to their friends and neighbors about local news more often than non-rural people, which is interesting. We find similar patterns in our statewide sample, that is, that the rural people are reporting to more often talk to their friends and neighbors about local news and state and national news compared with the non-rural Washington residents, but we don't have significant differences here. For using the cell phone to get news, we find a more dramatic difference in Washington state than in the national sample. But in both cases, we find that people in rural locations are significantly less likely to be reading the news on their cell phone compared to non-rural people. And we see that definitely significantly here in Washington state, where we have less than 20% of our rural population is reporting using cell phone to read news, whereas for non-rural we have about 40%. So it's about double the people in non-rural areas that are looking at their cell phones to read news. You know, I think there's a lot of buzz about social media as the place people are turning to for news. But survey after survey that come out that look at where do you get news, people are still turning to newspapers or newspaper websites to get their news, or blogs, for instance. So we have a significant difference, whereas rural people here nationally are looking at blogs less than non-rural people. But in both cases, we are at almost nobody is looking at blogs for news. And here is our statewide survey, and we're finding, slightly higher numbers than the national sample in both cases for looking at blogs, for looking at local news and looking at state and national news. And again, we're seeing that rural people are significantly less likely to look at blogs than non-rural people in both cases. And this is sort of a trend we see across internet, different ways of looking at news on the internet. Using search engines to find news, we find that rural people are less likely to report using search engines than non-rural people. And we find that for local news, for Washington residents, rural people are less likely to go to a news web portal like Google News or Yahoo News to look at local news. But we don't see a difference looking at state and national news for Washington residents. So again, what I think this indicates is it's not that people in rural areas don't know how to go to Google News or aren't using the internet to get news. It's that they're not going there to get local news because they can't find it on web news portals. Doug, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay. So getting at some of the implications of all of this, and we haven't teased out all of these data yet, but political knowledge we would consider to be one of the consequences of pullback of media from rural areas. And what we need to do is sort of use multi-level or multivariant models to essentially say, do those who perceive the most pullback or perceive the most difficulty in getting news, are they the ones who are suffering the most in terms of political knowledge? But this is just sort of comparing across rural and non-rural people. In terms of national political knowledge, there's no significant difference, but the trend is that rural people know more about national political issues. Can you name your congressperson? Do you know who, what majority is required to overturn a veto? Do you know, who determines the constitutionality of a law? That sort of thing. Rural people scored slightly better, but not significantly. In our Washington state sample, again, not significant, but lower levels in general. In terms of community participation, at the Washington level, what we see is, and you would expect this to be a significant difference, it probably eventually will when we get all of our responses in, rural people are much more participants in their community than are urban people. They're much, much more involved in their communities. And so my question is, how does this media pullback, do people who are accessing less local media, do they have less community participation? Because as some of the work that a graduate student of mine shows, that link between media participation and social cohesion has long-term implications for a community. You don't use the media, you're not a participant, you're less likely to feel a part of your community, and that leads to, in his case, crime. He's actually showing a link between local newspapers, community newspapers, and crime rates in small towns, and this is using national data. So just a few questions to leave you with. What happens when national news agendas impose on local public affairs? If you're not seeing local news and all you're seeing is national news through political talk radio, through the punditry that goes on cable news, or through the sort of he said, she said bipartisan bickering that comes from local newspapers, what choice do you have but to interpret local news through that filter of Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative? And so to what extent does a local issue like garbage collection suddenly become a polarized issue? And so that's a question we're hoping to tease out, and we've got some ways to do that with this data that we're hoping to see if that is one of the implications. Do we become more polarized as a community, whereas really we're just trying to solve local problems? We're trying to get textbooks for the local school. We're trying to pick up garbage. Why does that have to be a polarized issue? But you would expect it if that's your media diet, is polarization, which is what we're getting from national news. What happens when what's lost when community newspapers and other media disappear? And this is what I was talking about, see a decline of social participation, because we know those who participate most are big newspaper readers, are big users of political news on television and television websites. And then we know that social participation is a big link to social cohesion. Do our communities even hold together once we start losing our local media? Can internet and broadband and cell phone fill that gap? Well, that's open. I guess that's open for discussion, and that's where we'll leave it. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug and Michael. Butch Alford, you're down in Lewiston, and you have the paper here in town. What has happened to your coverage patterns of the number of communities in your footprint that you can cover?
We might be among the few that have not shrunk in terms of numbers. And I think maybe it's easier to operate in non-metropolitan areas today than in metropolitan areas. But it's tenuous. We're doing well. We're battling the number one, the Great Recession, and number two, we think we're making good progress in the new media area. But the interesting thing is going to be the next 10 years, as the business model continues to change. And an advantage that I think we have in terms of the footprint of news coverage, in print, online, mobile, et cetera, the challenge is going to be what happens with that business model in the next decade. And I don't know the answer to that. I know we'll be able to deal with it quicker, with more flexibility, in some ways, a little more movement than large organizations. That's an advantage of smaller newspapers, 25,000 in Lewiston and covering both states, and 8,000 in Pullman and Moscow.
Yep. Michael Shepard, a few years ago when I first arrived and I first started looking at this issue of local news access in the state. First time I drove across to Seattle and went through all the AT&T dead zones. and seriously, looking at the lack of media out there. You and I talked, and you were in charge of the Yakima paper at the time and the Walla Walla paper. And you gave me a picture of, we all know about cutbacks in local news in kind of the broad sense, but you kind of painted a picture for me of coverage area, reporters on the ground, boots on the ground, and circulation. Can you just talk about that little picture? Because I thought it really epitomized the challenge of
I think Yakima is maybe as good an example as there is in the state and perhaps the region, where Yakima County or the catchment area for the Yakima Herald Republic is bigger than many northeastern states, right? It covers a million acre, just part of its coverage area is the million acre Yakima Indian Reservation, right? Which is one of the big white holes on the coverage map for broadband. So that's just a piece of it, and they're going from Mattawa to the top of the Cascades and down to Prosser and Sunnyside and up north into Kittitas County. So it's a gigantic area. It's by far the largest news gathering organization there at with 30 some folks involved just in the news gathering piece of that organization, not just the news folks, not any of the support staff or advertising or admin or CERC. So you've got that entity, doing a pretty good job, but challenged by a rapidly changing marketplace, where advertising, classified advertising has moved into a different direction. Digital is an important piece of what's going on, and there's a lot of resource dedicated to that, but. And there's eyeballs associated with it, and their folks are coming there, but you've got ad rates on digital that not only were low to begin with, but have been cut in half or a quarter by the explosion of availability of digital advertising across not just media sites, but social network sites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just the daily newspaper, the biggest entity. You've got this discussion here about broadcast centers in the state. I was generously put at four. That includes Portland, right? So I assume, Doug. So you've got Portland, another state, and then Tri-Cities, Yakima, Spokane, Seattle. The television stations in that serve central Washington, all four networks are represented in Yakima, nominally have a presence. Unless it's changed, and I highly doubt it because it was headed quickly the other direction when I was there, the Fox broadcast into Yakima comes exclusively out of Spokane. The anchors are based in Spokane. I believe almost all, there may be one or two of the affiliates who have any anchors based in Yakima, the seventh largest city in the state at this point. All of those anchors are in the Tri-Cities at this point. One station, when I left, had its office for sale. And they had, I think, five people in the entire building, including sales folks. So, and in the county, you've got less than a handful of weekly newspapers to serve just in this county of a quarter million folks. If you're able to close the digital divide some, and I don't think it's a horrible situation in the state, closing the digital divide does not a informed citizen remake. Right. Let's let's remember that someone still has to pay a reporter to report, right. Okay? And I think that got, that gets a little lost in this conversation because, you've shelled out the, I think it's not unfair to say it's $150 a month by the time you pay your cable bill and your smartphone bill, da 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 da. Maybe that's low.
Yeah.
So
in my house it is.
Right. Okay. So that doesn't pay for a nickel's worth of reporting. None of that has been paid for at that point. So that's where the informed citizenry piece is challenged, and that's where we have to make the turn toward from depending on advertisers for that support to depending on citizens for that support, and we have to have them understand that paying for that first connection doesn't pay for the second one, right? But the wired world has provided tremendous access to our reporting. We have at the Seattle Times and any newspaper that's on the web has a much greater potential audience and real audience than it's ever had. We have, you know, we have 7 million uniques at the Seattle Times a month, three times what it was 2 years ago.
Sure.
That's a tremendous number. In addition to, you know, 300-something thousand on Sunday circulation. So our reporting is going, you know, places it's never gone and touching more people than ever. But it's very difficult to monetize aspects of that, and that's the real challenge we have. It's not for lack of adoption of digital; it's that the marketplace has changed so much, and we've been reluctant to. Well, Butch hasn't. We've been reluctant to charge for that digitally. That's changing, right, and right. Changing quickly.
Gary Graham, Spokesman Review. You're kind of the big boy in the region, the major paper in the region. What is your footprint now in terms of what you send reporters out to cover? What's the geographic spread, and has that changed over the years?
Yes, it has changed. I was just talking to one of our veteran editors who just celebrated his 26th year in the newsroom. When he came to Spokane from a small town in Montana, he remembered we actually had a Montana edition, if you can imagine that. We also, at one time, circulated in parts of Oregon. Incredible when you think about it now, because the distance, the geography. Fast forward to 2012, we have, we're still in North Idaho. We have a very small bureau in Coeur d'Alene. We cover about, really, three counties over there as best we can with a full-time reporter, photographer, and a blogger. On the Washington side, we have many more counties than that, but I've been at the Spokesman Review 8.5 years. There's no question that we have reduced our coverage in the what we would call the out counties. We used to have, for example, one reporter who was assigned to full-time to Stevens County. That was his beat. Well, that disappeared before it more than 8 years ago, because that beat didn't exist when I arrived. I would like to offer just a little bit of context here. Back in about 1993, when I was working for the Knight Ridder paper in Wichita, Kansas, we were a statewide paper. I mean, we sent that paper to all godforsaken corners of the state. In 93, we had a really smart publisher. And that is not an oxymoron. I have a lot of respect for publishers. They're much brighter than I am. But in 93, he decided we could no longer afford to circulate in Western Kansas. So we eliminated the Western Kansas edition. The newsroom was apoplectic, because we cut off in one stroke more than 10,000 subscribers.
Wow.
Can you imagine that? And that was in 1993. It was an economic decision at the time, but I think it also speaks to his foresight, because he saw what was coming. The cost of delivering a paper now with the price of gasoline, it's enormous, and it has made it much more difficult for us to find carriers who will deliver the paper and drive upwards of 80 to 90 miles round trip if they're lucky. And so that's, the economy certainly has been a contributing factor. It's interesting statistics that we're seeing today on rural readers or non-readers and their use of online. You know, we're like Butch's papers, we're trying to transition into the digital age. It's not been easy, and it's a little disheartening to listen to so much detail today about how difficult broadband access is. In North Idaho, where we have a lot of potential readers, they don't like to subscribe to us online because they're still using dial-up, and that's not very efficient.
I'd like to turn to the tech guys a little bit and talk about where in terms, and I'll start with Steve, and you all know Steve is with the Washington Technology Industry Association and formerly Microsoft. Where is the technology going? We've talked about the fact that, no matter how big you make the pipeline, somebody's going to make a bigger app, and it's a never-ending process. But in terms of this state, where is the technology going? What are there solutions coming from the tech industry that would begin to address some of the challenges we talk about?
Pretty broad question.
I know.
Some of the folks who represent some of the broadband providers here are probably better in a better position to address the specific issues around broadband. But it's clear both the demand for broadband as well as generally the capacity available is roughly doubling about every 9, 10, 12 months or something like that. And that's continuing. It's clear that it will continue. It's also clear, as we've had several discussions this morning, that it's going to be somewhat spotty because it's going to be more difficult for various reasons to get high bandwidth connectivity in some areas than others. Some of it's just purely capitalistic reasons. Some of it is other kinds of reasons. Some of it's technology reasons. But the technology reasons, actually, I think, are largely there's no magic there. I think there are clear solutions technically to being able to provide bandwidth. So the interesting part, and one of the reasons I kept asking questions about some of the media aspects of this and business model aspects this morning, was because I think that's where the much more interesting challenges are. The technology is available. It's certainly possible, as demonstrated in some places, that you can run fiber to homes in even small communities, and it works. You have to solve the backhaul problems. It's hard to get people to agree to even put, in some cases, cabinets, not even towers, in neighborhoods. So you have siting problems of various kinds. Those are going to continue. And then you have the socioeconomic issues related to, people being able, you have the possibility to get high bandwidth to your home or your residence, but even at $9.95 a month, you may not be able to afford it. And clearly we have to continue trying to find ways to address those. The other really interesting things that are going to continue at a probably even rapidly increasing pace, if you can believe it, on the technology side, are simply the kinds of end-user connectivity that's available. So, all of us in this room, sort of qualify as a relatively elite class. We're all carrying smartphones. A whole bunch of us are carrying, iPads or laptops or Macs or something. We're all sitting here answering email, during pauses in the conversation.
During the pauses in the conversation.
Multitasking, if you will. Even though psychologists have pretty well proved that we can't multitask. The bandwidth that's available to us here in this room, even though we've got 30 or 40 of us using it at any given time, obviously is pretty good.
Some complaints from the back corner, but
okay. That's because somebody has a jammer right behind that.
It must be Sprint customers.
That was very good of you to select the one carrier.
It's not here. Exactly. That's actually a tech rule.
But the end devices, the progress in the end devices is just amazing. Even if you just look at sort of incremental changes, this new iPad relative to the old iPad, it's incredible. The kinds of performance we're getting out of smartphones right now, the kinds of displays, the kind of bandwidth, the 4G coverage. There are a lot of places that probably if I walked out to the front room there where I actually have 4G connectivity on my phone, I would bet that I'd get higher bandwidth out of the wireless 4G connection on my phone than I do from their Wi-Fi. The technology, I think in many ways is going to continue to be way ahead of the political issues, the social issues, the socioeconomic issues that we have to deal with. And so I'm actually much more interested in focusing on that. And one of our big platform areas for the technology industry is, of course, education. Representative McCoy brought it up a couple times. Big need for STEM degrees. And there's a huge need to do a much better job starting that education in the K-12. Because we don't do a better job of that, then we don't have the people to feed the university and college systems around the state. And we're way, way behind in terms of our ability to turn out qualified technology graduates in this state. And in spite of that, you have companies like Google, Facebook, Zynga, go down the list. I'm probably missing a half a dozen of them, that have recently started locating engineering centers in the Pacific Northwest, specifically because they think it's attractive to attract people here. And then on top of that, you've got Microsoft with thousands of job openings and Amazon with thousands of job openings and so on and so forth. And we're having to struggle to import people to fill those openings. That's a whole bunch of different topics, but it's sort of the landscape I see.
You've been listening to a special broadcast on the Information Age today in the state of Washington. It was recorded at a day-long symposium at the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication, sponsored in part by a Carnegie Knight initiative exploring the future of journalism in the U.S. I'm John Paxson, Northwest Public Radio.